a fish, a flash, a silvery glow, a fighter bat, the range of a bow, the bird of the well, the end of the line, the dismay in your face is a loss, it's a fine, a spear, a spike, a point, a nail, a trip, a drop, the end of a tale, a truckload of bricks in the soft morning light, the sound of a gun in the dead of the night, a mile, a must, a thrust, a bump, it's a girl, it's a rhyme, it's a cold, it's a mumps, the plan of the house, the body in bed, and the car that got stuck, it's the mud, a float, a drift, a flight, a wing, a hawk, a queen. The promise of spring and the riverbank chalks are the waters of March. The end of our strain, the joy in your heart. So joy in your heart. A snake, a stick, it is John, it is Joe. It's a cut in your hand and a thorn in your toe. A point, a grain, a beat, a bite, a blink, a buzzer, a sudden stroke of night, a pin, a needle, and a sting, a pain, a snake, a riddle, a wasp, a sting, a pass in the mountains, a horse and a mule, in the distance the shelves brew, through shadows of blue, and the riverbank talks of the waters of March, it's the end of all strength, in your heart, a stick, a stone, the end of the road, the rest of a stump, a lonesome.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 2, KBOO's special programming campaign. Check out all the special programs we're bringing you in February and March at kboo.fm/thrills. Help us reach our goal of $17,000 by March 25th. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text us. Type in KBOO to the number 44321. For the thrill of it all, keep listening.
Did you feel that rumble? Did you hear that sound?
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Atomic Bamboozle, the false promise of a nuclear renaissance, on Sunday, March 12th from 2:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Atomic Bamboozle is a documentary film that challenges the proposed climate change solution of returning to nuclear power. The film will be followed by a Q&A with experts and advocates in the film. Again, that's Atomic Bamboozle, the false promise of a nuclear renaissance, on Sunday, March 12th from 2:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hey, we're Lost Lonely Boys, and you're listening to KBOO.
Makes you such a threat.
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Joshua. Umbete wastelo tonya wachianke chante waste na pechi uzapielo. Lei chante etaha owogalake le umkipiki he wastelo. Greetings and good day and welcome my relatives. I shake your hands with a good heart. This is a voice from Earth. It's good for all of us to be here. You are listening to First Voices Radio, Antiochus and Ghost Horse, sending you greetings and strength from the highlands of the Esopus, or what Americans and Dutch call the Castile Mountains. Regardless, it is the highlands of the Esopus in the lands of the Munsee speaking Lenape. This is an all-native hosted, all-native produced First Voices Radio, and Liz Hill is the producer of First Voices Radio. Today, our two guests, Charlie Lyons, a multimedia journalist, and Charlie Espinoza, who is a researcher and writer specializing in gold mining in the Amazon basin. They recently wrote an article, Mercury is a Complex Problem, a Q&A with Colombian mining minister Irene Velez Torres. Mangabay.com is where you can source the interview. The 2022 Colombian election of Gustavo Petro, a first left-wing president in decades, has fanned the winds of change throughout the country by vowing to tackle many of the nation's chronic issues, from violence and corruption in environmental problems and inclusivity. Among these are illegal extractive activities, particularly gold mining, which threaten ecosystems and indigenous communities. The administration has called for a transformation of mining regulations, formalization of small scale operations, a general cleaning up of the industry while keeping it profitable. I interviewed Charles Lyons and Charlie Espinoza not only about the data, but the attitude underneath the general cleaning up of the industry while keeping it profitable, in which I think it's an oxymoron at best. Thank you for joining us here. It's an honor to have you both, Charles Lyons and Charlie Espinoza. And this time we're going to focus in on Colombia, because I know you, Charles Lyons, talked about what was happening in Brazil and Suriname and the mining, the gold, the energy, basically, how native people are being affected by all of this onslaught of mining for gold, the forest for land, deforestation, agriculture. We could go on and on here, but in location where you are is in Brazil, as you are, Charles Lyon, and Charlie Espinoza, you being in Southern California, and your experience of seeing and actually reporting on the mining, the preferential treatment by certain governments and, you know, newfound governments and dictatorial governments, and all underneath this are the peoples, the native peoples, and then the Afro-Colombians, the Afro-Ruvians. So what I'm trying to get at, the indigenous peoples have this view from the shore. Everybody else came in on the ships. So that perspective is hardly heard from. What is formalized as far as governments are concerned, whether they're puppet governments or governments of the people, and how much that is really affecting the land and the native peoples, even Afro-Colombians who are being told to fight against each other, and as native people also are being torn apart because the land is not giving them the purity it once did. In Colombia, in this case, all that has been set up in the past through things like CAFTA, AFTA, in NAFTA in North America, those preliminary treaties that really are in place now to displace anything native people, anybody working on and garnering substance from the land, subsistence living. So I want to go from there. Let's start with you, Charles Lyons.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back on your show. I think it's an interesting parallel between a number of the countries that have just shaken off the yoke of brutal governments, very conservative, very almost dictatorial in the case of Brazil, but also in Colombia, where these invasions of indigenous land have been allowed to flourish, have been allowed to happen for the last 4 years. As strongly and as openly, the borders have been porous. The borders, the resistance has been null. And what you see in the north of Brazil, in the extreme north in Roraima, is that thousands of garimpeiros, wildcat miners, have basically, now that the Lula government is in place, and this is similar to Colombia, now that the Petro government is in place, they're starting to crack down on these illegal miners, the miners that have invaded indigenous territory. But they haven't sort of, in a macro sense, solved any problems. What they're doing is throwing these people out, and it's not the miners' fault. In most cases, they're working for conglomerates, syndicates, crime syndicates. And they're throwing them out, and all they're doing is they're going to other countries. In the case of Brazil, they're going to Venezuela. They're going to Guyana. I'm not sure where they're going in Colombia. Charlie might be able to speak to that. But the point is they're not solving the problem in a kind of global macro way. And what we just wrote about, was the situation in Colombia where the new government has come in, and the new government is trying to figure out, by broad consultation with so many stakeholders, what is the best way forward that really takes in consideration the rights of Afro-Colombians, indigenous, and many other groups. Charlie, I don't know if you want to pick up from there.
I would just add, and thank you, by the way, I feel very honored to be on the show. I would just add that Colombia has a long history of really favoring multinational companies, making it possible for bigger mining companies to work in areas and land grab, and has made it comparatively very difficult for, much smaller communities. So this is sort of coming from a long history of frustration and policy that favors multinationals.
So when both of you talk about multinationals, you know, and we know in the workings of the media that we do, and those of us who have really understand between the lines, that a lot of this financing of these multinational corporations wasn't allowed until a certain time period in the 90s. But who is backing them up even now that we don't hear about?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that there's a couple layers to that question. One is there are, of course, investors who invest. A mining company does, an exploration and then makes an announcement that they have potential, found potential mineral riches in an area, and then investors will back these very large operations. I think on another level, you can think about it in terms of consumers, and especially in the United States and Europe. There's many consumers don't know about the impacts of gold and other minerals when they're buying. Smartphones contain gold and jewelry as well. So they're fueling these impacts and in many cases aren't aware of it.
So the investment is widespread. You find European countries, the US, in some way stakeholders. China, for example, is very big in Latin America and in Brazil, and own mines in Suriname, as we discovered in our article on Suriname. They get better deals. The multinationals get better deals, and often they deal with the governments. So in the case of Guyana, as I'm soon going to explore, there's a lot of sort of looking the other way because their concessions, their paybacks, and unless it reaches a crisis point, as it has in Brazil, where the Yanomami in the north of Brazil, extreme north state of Roraima and also Amazonas, have been invaded in the last 4 years. There's malnutrition, there's pollution of the rivers from mercury. Because this big business of illegal gold mining has been allowed to flourish. So how do you get control out of that? And what can the Lula government do? What can the Petra government do? And what can other governments do when they come in? And that was one of the fascinating things we explored in our article in Mangabe, in Colombia. What is this consultation process? How is it going to affect the individual miners? And as you saw, we spoke to one miner who felt a little unsure how he was going to benefit from this reform process.
Charlie Espinoza, you talked about the layers of maybe deception. I could go that far, because what I'm reading here is if the miners are skeptical in that they are being displaced, really, if you can go that far with moving from Brazil to other parts of South America, they need jobs as anything else. But if you think about what these miners are actually doing under this left-wing government of Gustavo Petro, what is the man behind the curtain doing now? When he came to power, he said, you all wrote that he came to power pledging to transform Colombia's mining industry. So it's just, what'd he do? He's changed hands of, you know, what one sees. They really don't know what they're really doing, because there comes the skepticism.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a long history from, so the article centered around an Afro-Colombian artisanal miner by the name of Carlos Latorre, who he works in the Pacific region. And I think something important to understand about him and his community is that they're working on a very, very small scale, and the environmental impact is low. They're not using mercury as many other miners do. And they've been practicing that form of mining for a long time. So these communities are descendants from runaway slaves, in fact. And they've basically needed to find, forms of subsistence and survival in the jungle where they've been living for a while. So, to your question, I think that Carlos and other miners have to be very skeptical, because there's laws and there's government promises, and then there's actual what ends up, you know, affecting them and what actually ends up reaching their community. So Colombia is one of the only, if I think the only Latin American country to have banned mercury in gold mining use. And they banned it in 2018. But for a lot of communities, that law hasn't really been seen in any kind of real way, because they're still experiencing mercury contamination. For example, the article mentioned there are a number of indigenous communities in the Colombian Amazon basically tried to sue the government, the Colombian government, because they said, well, this mercury ban took effect in 2018. We're supposed to have rights to our territories. And yet there's all this mining in our territories. There's still mercury contamination. We're eating fish that are contaminated with mercury. So you're not, you know, fulfilling the promise that you made, and you're not fulfilling the law that you set out. So I think there can be a really big gap between what a government promises and what's on the surface, and then what actually happens on the ground.
I think to their credit, and I don't want to be the guy who's pro-government or pro-institutions, but this woman that's been brought on as the Minister of Mines, Irene Velez, very interesting background. She's studied philosophy, cultural studies. You know, she's a thinker, and she's done lots of interesting work in the country, along with the vice president, who herself is Afro-Colombian, have tried to really engage groups that they feel have been marginalized for years, not just the last four. So I think that's to their credit. I mean, what they come up with will be interesting to see 6 months from now when they introduce a new mining code. But their consultations have been extremely broad. I think, what was it, a few thousand people they've consulted with. So we'll see whether there's that continual gap between what the promise is and what the delivery is.
You all both know that the EIS, or Environmental Impact Statement, in the United States, it's like a delay tactic for many things, mining lithium in Nevada now. They're going to start that mining in a couple months, if not already. Things that went on in Standing Rock. So the EIS statements basically have no teeth. So when you talk about the new mining code that's on its way, do you, both of you or any of you, have privy to what really that, what the mining code really entails, besides just the banning, which is not really true anymore as it is that we can say it is in Mercury in 2018? Of course, they're looking for better conditions, as you wrote, across Colombia. Will it be too late kind of legislation? Because it seems like these governments are very volatile. You know, who's going to be the next one? And if they don't satisfy a certain elite group in Colombia?
Yeah, I'll try to answer that to my knowledge and just say, I think that, so there's, I guess, two different sides to the coin. One is that on the one hand, you had our miners like Carlos Artisanal, extremely marginalized and poor, and they were being asked to do things to formalize that were on the same level as what multinational companies are being asked that cost thousands of dollars to, for example, do things that, you know, to hire a consultant to be able to do an environmental impact study. So I think that one thing the government's trying to do is make that more attainable for and affordable for those miners. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, what they're doing for multinationals, I know one thing is that they are trying to, as it stands now, you don't in Colombia, these multinationals have been able to explore land for minerals without any kind of environmental impact statement or plan. And it was only once they officially started mining and designated a place that they had to create a environmental impact assessment. So I know one thing the government's trying to do is to get those the environmental plans more, be more broad and include the whole process so multinationals can't have to be more responsible for their activities across more of the exploration process. Charlie, maybe you...
It's just, again, what I was saying before about, you know, the criminal syndicates are very powerful in so many Latin American and Latin American countries and in Brazil that, and I like what Colombia is doing. What's happening in Brazil is a little different because they're focusing on these problem areas like what happened with the Yanomami in the north in Roraima and Amazonas. But they're neglecting other areas like Pará, and other states where the problem is still enduring. And the problem is the enforcement mechanisms. Mm. You can't oversee this much territory, not only in Brazil and Colombia, Venezuela. I mean, Venezuela is kind of a whole nother situation where it's kind of at the phase where Colombia and Brazil were. It's just impossible to oversee and to really enforce. So they're going in and they're, you know, we wrote about the dredges, the explosion of dredges, the crippling of some of the infrastructure that is both in Colombia and Brazil in order to stop this illegal gold mining. But again, it's just such big territory and the corrupt elements know how to get around. You might stop them for a while, but they're going to reappear and they're just going to shift their location. And unfortunately, it's the indigenous whose land many of these illegal actions are taking place on that are the ones that suffer the most by intimidation, abuse, you know, all kinds of things. When I was in, just a last little anecdote, when I was in Roraima trying to investigate a little bit of the situation of the Yanomami up near Pacaraima, which is near the Venezuelan border, I saw on bus stops out in the middle of nowhere, but little bus stops, anti-Indigenous statements scribbled, now Indigenista, now Indigenista. And it's this angry sentiment that was propped up by Bolsonaro, that somehow the indigenous on the land are slowing progress. And that is something that is throughout Latin America.
Wow. So this age-old demand for gold disease, of course, we can say, we point fingers, but when it comes down to it, we can say, well, the practice needs to be cleaned up, mining techniques, anything that the government puts out because of the new mining laws coming out. We can say EIS statements. We went through all the channels to say that we're doing the proper thing. But yet, is it really about cleaner mining techniques? Do we need the gold? It seems like throughout, from my experience of talking to you about Suriname and Brazil and Bolivia and Colombia, these standards aren't good enough because they're doing what they're doing to native peoples. The land, whether it's being cleared for cattle, is still, that's the first move, is you clear the indigenous peoples out, then you clear the land, then next thing you know, it's open to devastation. Whose responsibility is that when we can point at all the do's and don'ts? But when it comes down to it, to me as an indigenous person, it's still that view from the shore, Charlie and Charles. It's still the view from the shore that I'm offering here. So maybe changing the language, the view from the ships made Potosi the biggest mining source of silver in the world. Yeah, and I think that's in Bolivia, and authors have written about it. What I'm saying is, why do we make this? We don't hear about it until it's done. Like what happened here, 98.5% of Native people in North America were wiped out, right? And so, but we only talked to the 2.5% left, or 1.5% left, or something like this. And that's a small fraction of the story. Here we have a chance through reports like you're doing, the influx of Americans or the United States citizens to go down there and yet gentrify. Because to me, all these mechanical mining techniques has thought to it. We gentrify the land, whether it's on the right or left. So where's the hope that people look for that this is going to stop until there's nothing to hope for?
I'm glad you said all that and put this issue in a broader perspective about what are we, what's going on here. And I don't have an easy answer, but I think that, do we need gold? I mean, do we need to wear gold? Do we need to, do people need to be investing in gold as a hedge against inflation, for example, when it's causing all these harmful impacts in communities? I mean, I would just say that I think that for me, the reason that I became inspired to work on this issue and to spread awareness about this issue is because this is not something that's going on in some faraway place. This is something that is having real effects in those places, but it is really, in my view at least, the root of it is coming from a demand in my own country. So if we have, you know, incentives and demands in place where people are in the United States are really fueling gold mining on a really large scale and fueling these impacts in Amazon countries and across the world, people really need to know about that and need to reflect on impacts of consumer choices. So to me, this is a really interconnected issue, and it's not something that's we can in the United States just sort of wash our hands of and say this is going on somewhere else. And, you know, there's this government trying to do this about it. To me, it's really an interconnected problem.
Charles.
I just wanted to say also that there's a lot of discussion. It was just a New Yorker piece about indigeneity. And one of the things that gets left out of these historical discussions, I think, is the role that indigenous play in preserving the land and protecting the land. Yeah. And this insatiable desire for gold is another sort of invasion. Whether you co-opt indigenous interests or not, it's still an invasion. And it turns these landscapes into awful dystopic in images of destruction and
and really sad to see with little consistent sense of the reforesting that needs to be done. So yeah, there's somehow, if consumers, as Charlie was saying, were more aware in our country and in other countries of the impacts on the ground to people, to environments, that would really potentially change the tide. It's not been a good tide at all.
Just to go on out here, a small floating thought I've had is that it's people like you and others that I know that I've talked to over the years recently. There's a certain amount of the human species awakening, so much to know that we are all caught up in this colonial coma that we need to wake up from. And we work out of that colonial coma that constantly wants to put us back to sleep. And as you say, we don't want to put it on the table. It's the elephant in the room, but it's a deception, even in our own language, to say that we're not part of this, because we separate ourselves by saying I instead of we. And I think that that is not just basically personal sovereignty. What we're looking for is somebody who really can speak, walk the talk. And I'd like to thank both of you. Any final words?
I just want to say it's always a pleasure to be on the show. I should probably mention that both of us work with Amazon Aid Foundation as consultants, through whom, you know, we are able to write these articles for MangaPay.
Ditto, and I really appreciate being on the show and thinking about this in a broader way. So thank you so much for having both of us.
All right, Charlie Espinoza and Charles Lang, thank you so much for being here on First Voices Radio. Good to see you both.
Nice to see you.
Correspondent Ann Kayla Kelly updates us about Thacker Pass, which First Voices Radio has been following closely since January 2021. She talks with activist lawyer Will Falk, who with activist photographer Max Wilbert started an occupation at Thacker Pass on January 15th, 2021 to stop construction of a proposed lithium mine in Thacker Pass, Nevada, known as Pihimuha in the Paiute language. A new lawsuit was filed in federal district court on February 16th by three nations, Reno Sparks Indian Colony, Burns Paiute Tribe, and Summit Lake Paiute Tribe. This is a new lawsuit against the U.S. federal government over Lithium Nevada Corporation's planned Thacker Pass lithium mine, the latest move in what has become a two-year struggle over mining, greenwashing, and sacred lands in northern Nevada. And thank you, Kayla Kelly.
Aloha, Will, and welcome to First Voices Radio.
Aloha, Kayla. Thanks for having me be here.
Will, can you tell us about the ruling recently in federal court that led to this new lawsuit?
Yeah. So in the original lawsuit, there was a rancher who sued the government for issuing the permit for the Thacker Pass project. There was four regional environmental groups, and then there were two Indian tribes, one being the Reno Sparks Indian Colony, who I represented, and another, the Burns Paiute Tribe, who I did not represent. And essentially, all of us lost all of our arguments except for one. And that argument was primarily advanced by the environmental plaintiffs. But I guess in a nutshell, what the ruling means is that the whole project can move forward except for one small aspect of the project. There is this land that the corporation wants to bury under waste rock, and the Bureau of Land Management is not supposed to allow them to dump their waste there unless the corporation can prove that there is a valuable mineral underneath the land that they want to bury under the waste rock. So unless the corporation can prove that they have a valid mineral claim under that waste rock. What the judge ordered was the rest of the project can go forward. And as soon as the Bureau of Land Management can verify that the corporation does indeed have valid mineral claims underneath the waste rock pile, then they can start to bury that land under the waste rock.
because the project was fast-tracked and the government worked so quickly to issue the permit, it obviously cut a lot of corners, and one of the corners that it cut was tribal consultation. So it did not actually have any interaction with tribes over this project. There's probably around 20 to 25 regional tribes who descend from people who would have routinely lived in or moved through Thacker Pass. And so in the last couple of years, the Bureau of Land Management has been trying to catch up with the consultation that it should have given the tribes before issuing the permit. And while doing that, they've made a lot of mistakes, and from my client's perspective, violated several laws. So we have filed this new lawsuit based.
Well, hold on a second before we talk about the new lawsuit. Okay. Since it was fast tracked and the tribes weren't consulted, did the judge order them to go back and consult?
No.
Because that's actually part of the federal law, is that they have to consult. Am I wrong about that?
Well, you're not wrong, except for the government agencies like the Bureau of Land Management have a really wishy-washy definition of consultation. And judges, the law says that judges, for the most part, are supposed to grant deference to these administrative agencies. What judges tend to do is they allow the very barest minimum of things like consultation. And then, of course, if certain parties don't actually sue over this, then a judge won't look to see, say, one of the tribes that was originally identified as needing consultation in this case, and a tribe that is now one of my clients, the Summit Lake Paiute Tribe. The Summit Lake Paiute Tribe was not a part of the original lawsuit. So when we wanted to offer letters that the Summit Lake Paiute Tribe wrote to the Bureau of Land Management saying, "You never consulted with us," mm-hmm. The judge said, "Well, the Summit Lake Paiute Tribe is not a part of this case right now, so I'm not going to let you bring those letters, and I'm not going to consider the fact that those letters exist."
So in a way, doesn't the judge rule, you know, saying that basically push them to have to file a lawsuit by saying, yeah, she's sort of saying you'd sort of have to sue in order for that to be relevant? Is that?
Yes. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, one of the aspects, judges, you know, they jealously guard their schedule. And getting a lawsuit together is normally a time intensive and resource intensive. A lot of times it costs a lot of money to file a lawsuit. So forcing tribes to file a lawsuit before a judge will consider aspects of a case like this is sort of a deterrent, and sort of a, I doubt the judge would say an intentional deterrent, but the way that the law is designed, it operates as a deterrent.
I see. Okay, so tell us about who are these three tribes and what is this, the significance of this new lawsuit that you folks have filed?
Yeah, the new lawsuit is being brought by three tribes, the Reno Sparks Indian Colony and the Summit Lake Paiute Tribe, who I represent, and then the Burns Paiute Tribe, who has their own lawyer, but we've all joined forces to file this new lawsuit. And most of the arguments made in this new lawsuit deal with things that the Bureau of Land Management have done since issuing the permit. One of the things that has happened is once the tribes actually were notified about the project and had a chance to understand what the project was, where it would be, they informed the Bureau of Land Management of two massacre sites in the project area and insisted that the government recognize, the legal term for this is recognize that this is the tribe's traditional cultural property, and that they're entitled to what's called a post-review discovery process. So basically consultation, they're entitled to consultation even though the permit has been issued, but construction has not started. So the agency should have consulted with the tribes about basically offered them the consultation that they didn't get before the permit was issued. BLM did in fact say they were going to do that, and then proceeded to ignore the tribe's letters, comments, requests for information about the project area, about, you know, how to maybe avoid destroying certain aspects of Thacker Pass. And so this new lawsuit deals mostly with stuff that has happened after January 15th, 2021, when the Thacker Pass permit was issued, as opposed to the first lawsuit, which dealt with stuff that happened before January 15th, 2021.
I see. Right. Okay. I understand. So what have they actually done out there at this point? It's Lithium Nevada is the name of the corporation, right?
That's, yes, Lithium Nevada. They have, the first maybe worst thing they've done is they have already completed an initial round of their archaeological excavations. So, you know, this probably will be no surprise to Native listeners, but to non-Native listeners, especially in a place like Nevada, there's virtually no land that is not covered in the artifacts of the people who have lived there forever. Thacker Pass is no exception. There was something like over 1,000 cultural resource sites, which are defined as, I believe, having 20 or more artifacts within the area, within a certain area. So Thacker Pass is literally covered with artifacts that have been created by Paiute people and their ancestors, Western Shoshone people and their ancestors, and probably other nations as well.
This includes burial sites, I'm assuming.
A Paiute tradition is to leave the dead in caves or stone outcroppings, or bury them not underground, but on the ground with stones on top of them. Mm-hmm. The northern a big part of the Thacker Pass lithium mine project area encompasses a lot of caves and stone outcroppings that would have traditionally been used to place the dead in. So we think it's very likely that those places are going to be disturbed. At the same time, there were at least 31 Paiute people massacred in Thacker Pass on September 12, 1865. The soldiers said that they did not make a search through the sagebrush. They said, "We didn't make a search through the sage to actually count how many people we killed." So we think it's highly likely that most of the people killed in that massacre were just left there. And contemporary Paiute people say that it's unlikely that people would have wanted to go back to that massacre site. One, just for the sheer psychological trauma of seeing your relatives rotting bodies, but also the cavalry would be expecting something like that, so they would watch over those sites and round up any people that came to kind of clean things up. There were also would be certain religious strictures about how to pray for those people, and that would not have been possible with the cavalry monitoring things. So yes, we think that the final resting places of Paiute people who were murdered by the American government will be destroyed by this lithium mine.
What is it that you are asking for in the lawsuit? What are the tribes trying to accomplish?
The biggest thing that is possible for us to accomplish is what's called a vacature of the permit, or there's a collection of permits that we recently discovered that Lithium Nevada actually possesses, stuff we didn't know about until this past fall. So we're actually going to be asking for the judge to vacate all those permits, and vacature means that it's like the permit wasn't issued. But it's really important that people understand that there is no mechanism in American law for us to go into a court and say, you must not let this mine happen. You must not let this place be disturbed. All we can do is force an undoing of the current permits. But what that means practically is that the corporation and the government will just correct the mistakes that they made in issuing the permit the first time, so that they'll get the permit again. And, you know, it'll be a lot harder to challenge them the second time when there's a federal judge pointing out problems with their permit application that they can just simply fix and be ready to go.
I've seen that happen a lot here in Hawaii, where we're really just talking about legal technicalities is all you're able to do, is call them out on a technicality. Yes. Basically, you can't really stop them in the courts. So that leads me to another question. What kind of pressure can be brought to bear, you know, locally or just on the federal level, whether it's with the Department of Interior's, you know, Deb Haaland, who I would hope would be on the side of the tribes because she's the first Native American to run that department. And I'm just wondering, like, what kind of pressure can be brought? Is it political? I mean, at some point the legal doesn't work. So what's the strategy, or can you share that with us?
Yeah, I think broadly, it's really important for everybody to understand that in campaigns like these, eventually the lawsuits and the legal tactics exhaust themselves. And there's, we try every single thing we can. And while those things may delay projects, there will come a certain point where we have no legal ability to delay the projects. One of the political pressure points here, it's important to understand that Deb Haaland has been like pointedly ignoring us on this issue. You know, the Biden administration, one of their key platform things is this whole so-called green energy revolution, which really just means destroying what's left of the land for new technologies. But we haven't gotten Ms. Haaland to respond to us, acknowledge us. We have now, in fact, we named her as the first party in our lawsuit. So the lawsuit actually is called Reno Sparks Indian Colony versus Deb Haaland. So we are hoping to get her attention. There are things, one of the things that would be really hard to achieve but is theoretically possible is if we could get someone like Deb Haaland to agree to just sort of place a full pause on any sort of mining activity in Thacker Pass while Congress investigates designating Thacker Pass as something like a national historic landmark. There is the Sand Creek Massacre in Colorado is a place that has gained this high of a designation. But I would caution people to understand that it took 20 years for Sand Creek to go through that whole process to be protected.
What was the threat to Sand Creek at that time?
Well, you know what? There might not have actually even been a threat. There was just mm-hmm. this realization that most of the Sand Creek Massacre was on public land. That's significant because in the United States, Congress has designated the highest and best use of public land to be mining, and that includes Native American traditional or cultural or spiritual concerns. So if a tribe says this is the most sacred place in the world, and it's on public land and a mining corporation locates valuable minerals, the law says that they have to give the permit to the corporation to destroy the place. So I think what happened with Sand Creek is they realized that as long as Sand Creek was on public land, the massacre site was on public land, it would be in danger of mining claims. And so they initiated a process to get the government to essentially withdraw the Sand Creek Massacre site from the public lands designation in order to more permanently protect Sand Creek.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's really a worthy goal for Thacker Pass. I think it should be considered doable, and it might actually be the thing, the direction everything ends up in if protests indeed have to take place, because I actually think this could turn into a something like a Standing Rock protest if the government is going to consistently side with the mining industry. I listened in on the Facebook live conversation that you did with Max Wilbert, who's the original, he's the leader, really. He's the first guy that was out there on this with you. And one of you, I don't know if it was you or him, but one of you said that Thacker Pass is seen as like a national security issue. And so that gives the government the motivation to just ignore what the Native people need in terms of their protections. Is that true? Did I hear that right?
Yeah, it's, I mean, the corporation, Lithium Nevada, one of the things that, you know, they jump up and down saying in court is, you know, being able to access a domestic supply of lithium is, you know, makes us less reliant, us, makes the United States less reliant on, say, China or foreign sources of lithium. Of course, this is an argument that's been made since Europeans arrived on this continent, that, you know, just this once, we're going to have to destroy more native land because the empire needs it. And of course, you know, 500 years of just this once, there's hardly anything left.
Yeah, that's the tragedy. You know, that's colonization. It's never stopped. I think most people, when people talk about decolonization or post-colonization, rather, I always shake my head. Like, why do they say that? Who are they talking about? Because they're not talking about anybody I know. They're talking about any Native people I know, because the right. Colonial project is an extraction project. It's about Absolutely. Going in and erasing the first people of the place, paving over them, and extracting whatever it is, like you said, the empire wants it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's important, like, one of the things that really hits me about this whole thing is, so in the Paiutes who were massacred in 1865 in Thacker Pass were massacred as part of what was called the Snake War. And the Snake War, which historians have called the bloodiest, you know, conflict with Native Americans west of the Mississippi River, it was primarily fought as Native American traditional food sources have been destroyed by primarily mining and ranching. And so these people were resisting the expansion of mining on their land, and they were murdered for it. And now, you know, 160 years later, things have so thoroughly not changed that you have the interests of the mining industry coming in to destroy the evidence that this massacre even happened. So, yeah, the post-colonization, it's, you know, maybe it's not people getting massacred like in 1865, though that is happening in a lot of places. But one of the reasons why people aren't getting massacred in 2023 is because they already did the massacring back in 1865, and people know what happens when you stand up to projects like this.
Yeah, and you know, we'd all like not to have to find out what it's going to be like if we all have to go out there and protest and stand there with the tribes and with you and Max and any other of the activists who had the courage to show up for this beautiful place. I've never been there, but just the images I've seen are just absolutely stunning. Will, can you tell people where they can go for more information about this struggle to protect Thacker Pass?
Yeah, the first place would be protectthackerpass.org. Thacker is T-H-A-C-K-E-R. And another place would be the Reno Sparks Indian Colonies website, which I believe is just rsic.org. But yeah, those are two places where you can find updates and understand what's going on.
Will Falk, author, lawyer, all-around warrior from Mother Earth. You know, I want to thank you so much for coming on First Voices Radio today to discuss this new lawsuit, and we look forward to updates in the near future.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me and giving Thacker Pass a platform.
Keala Kelly, Pilamaya Yellow, and to Will Falk, thank you.
Kayla Kelly comes all the way from Hawaii to as one of our lead correspondents, and I want to thank her once again. Anagopta Nankapi Kihe Klamia Yapi. Makawazi Wogalake et Hantan Taya Anagopta Yo. Anawichao Gopta Anagopta Wichamake. Tokshaake Wachianke Te. And I wanted to thank all of you for joining us here at First Voices Radio. Thank you for listening. Thank you all for listening. When a grandfather or grandmother speaks, listen to him or her carefully. And I listened to them when I was young, and I sat listening to them while I was young. And I will see you again eventually, but surely. My name is Teokasin Ghost Horse.
Stood still on a highway, I saw a woman by the side of the road, with a face that I knew like my own, reflected in my window. Well, she walked up to my quarter light, and she bent down real slow, a fearful pressure paralyzed me in my shadows. She said, son, what are you doing here? My fear for you has turned me in my grave. I said, Mama, I come to the valley of the rich, myself to sell. She said, son, this is the road to hell. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy lunes 6 de marzo del 2020.